What up, people? This is episode 240, and this episode is a solo episode, or as I'm calling it, one man's bad movie review. And that might be a theme going forward when I do have to do these solo episodes. With apologies to Matt Basler, I did not reach out to him to fulfill it. I'm just throwing in this 30-40 minutes where I can get it in during the day. That said, you're going to hear at the top of the episode what we've got coming up in the next few weeks, so we will be back to normal. But for now, you hear me talk about a few things right before jumping into it. I put the Throw It to Missy segment right at the beginning. Then I jump into the episode, which is different. Which might be, I don't know if that format's going to stick, but maybe that'll get people out of the way on maybe people's normal favorite segment in the Throw It to Missy. I don't know. But either way, this is one man's bad movie review, and it's of Streets of Rage, 1984 epic, starring Michael Parra, Diane Lane, Amy Madigan, among others, including Willem Dafoe. And you will hear that right after the bomb goes off, which should be now. That's what I would normally say. Instead, what I'm going to tell you is I am back because this episode is a solo episode, which we'll get into here in a little bit on what I'm choosing to do with that solo episode. Just know that this episode came about because of a lot of conflicting schedules, mainly on my end, that we couldn't get everybody together. But I promise you, we will rectify that in the next couple weeks. In fact, next week, Jay and I plan to be at Exit 6 recording an episode with the owners for their 10th anniversary, which I can't believe it's been 10 years since Exit 6 has been a thing. But that's awesome because we really like their beer, really like their location, and it's kind of the meeting hangout for my high ABV bike club, and it's going to be the hangout for next week's episode. And then the week after that, we'll have a normal an abnormal episode because it's our annual Halloween episode with Michael Schilling. Michael, the Zombie Man Schilling. He's going to join us. We're going to watch a movie, discuss the movie as we watch it, and, talk about all things spooky season. So that's what you got to look forward to. But in this episode, the reason, like I said, the reason it's just me is because of conflicting schedules. But one thing that you should note about this episode, this is actually the second time I'm recording it. I shot some in last night, or sat down and shotgunned one last night. And I'm going to go with kind of the same thing I talked about, but I kind of really rushed through it. I don't think it captured exactly what I wanted it to capture. And that is, I'm going to, in these solos episodes from now on, in these solo episodes, I don't know why I put an S on solos. It's only one solo, the Han Solo, not both Han and Leia. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to take a bad movie, or at least a quirky, cheesy movie from like the 80s, 90s, probably even 70s from time to time, and I'm going to review that movie. And because I typically watch these movies by myself, so why not review them by myself? And today's movies is a pretty fun one that I didn't know about, but I'll get to that in a little bit. Before I get to that, I did want to talk about a couple of things that's going on right now. Kind of doing like a Throw It to Missy segment before I jump into the movie. What I wanted to talk about is, one, the final episode of What If came out today, and I watched it, and I enjoyed it. And I wanted to bring up, apparently some rooms on the internet, some parts of the interweb mansion has kind of turned on What If a little bit, mainly bleedingcool.com, which we've talked about in the past on this show, which I got to tell you, Bleeding Cool, sometimes your articles are written just to hate on things, and you kind of suck. And in fact, sometimes they're not even written that well. And listen, I can throw stones because one thing that you need to do in order to be able to throw stones is have experience. Now, I certainly don't have experience in writing articles for a news, quote unquote news, or even a hobby news or pop culture news outlet. But I do have experience writing articles and giving my opinion. And I am not going to say I'm the best. And the reason I feel like I'm experienced enough in this category to bitch about Bleeding Cool is that I know bad writing when I see bad writing because I, too, am a bad writer. Sometimes I hit one out of the park or get lucky and hit a bloop single. But every article that I see from Bleeding Cool of late, especially about the MCU, or more specifically Disney Plus's MCU, is full of hate. In this instance, they talk about boring and how the underlying story was set up poorly and stuff. And I'm going to go back to what this is based on, and that's the What If comic books. Get over it. Those comic books were meant to be these one-off self-contained stories, and occasionally, yes, occasionally they would have multi-parters, but they were always, this is kind of what they were, and even when this show was at its worst, it was entertaining, and it was worth watching. And I got to tell you, now that it's wrapped up, and it's done some things that it's done in terms of the multiverse, I think it's going to have far-reaching effects, and I think they did a pretty darn good job of setting all that up. So, and I've said before what I think about Dark Doctor Strange. I think that we're going to see him in the new Spider-Man flick. That's just my opinion, and if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. Lord knows Marvel throws a lot of curveballs at us, which is good. It keeps us on our toes, but I think that people at Bleeding Cool just need to lighten the fuck up. You kind of suck. You know, maybe that's why you're not at Comic Book Resources or comicbook.com. I don't know. I don't know. Bleeding Cool should not be the title of your website if these are the constant bitching articles. I kind of think that maybe they were the ones they might have shared. I can't say this for certain, so if I'm wrong about this, Bleeding Cool, I apologize. But I think you guys also had an article about Anthony Mackie about his homophobic, quote-unquote, homophobic rant, which was so ridiculous that anybody would call it that. And then I think you just hated on Falcon and Winter Soldier to begin with. It's almost like you don't know your readers. And if I know these are opinion pieces, and it is your opinion, but your opinion seems solely based on the reason that you want to be inflammatory to get people to read it. And I guess mission accomplished. I read it. I don't know why I keep reading your articles. Maybe to fire up and give me ammo for this. I guess in that respect, kudos to you. So that's one thing I want to talk about. The other thing I want to talk about, since I'm doing the Throw It to Missy segment ahead of time, is I just recently watched a movie that I'd always had on my list and never watched it before, and that was Odd Thomas with Anton Yelich, Willem Dafoe, a little bit of a Patton Oswalt cameo for some reason, and then a couple other people. It's based on a book written by Dean Koontz, Koontz. So the character, the whole premise is based on this character, Odd Thomas, which that is his real name, is a short order cook by design, who's also clairvoyant and can communicate with the dead and gets these premonitions and does all this cool shit. And there's a lot that goes with that. And then there's this overarching thing. It's put it this way. It's really cool how the bad guys in the story know about Odd Thomas and decide to mess with his ability and then thus pull off whatever they're trying to pull off. Critics were a little harsh on this. I saw that it was like 30% critics, but it was like 60% from the audience score. I thought it was good. I think it's like 3.75, borderline 4 out of 5. I think the saddest thing about it is it was so entertaining enough, probably a movie I will watch again. But the saddest thing about it is it was set up perfectly to be some kind of franchise. And of course, we're not getting that thanks to the untimely and definitely a freak death of Anton Yelich, who was just a pretty solid, he's a pretty solid actor, and even more so, a pretty darn good genre actor. He was in Fright Night. He was, you know, Chekhov in Star Trek. He was Odd Thomas. The Fright Night remake, I should say. He was good at everything he did. Really, when you watch his movies that you'd never seen before, you rediscover his movies. Not to mention Alpha Dog. He was great in Alpha Dog. Maybe one of the most depressing movies of all time. It sucks that his career was cut short by this tragedy or his life in general, because I'm sure by all accounts, he was a cool dude from what everybody said. So he probably had a lot more to offer humanity, and he definitely had a lot more to offer, pop culture. So that sucks, but I highly recommend it. Like I said, it's borderline 4 out of 5 for me, borderline. It's like 3.75 with a lean towards 4. So I would definitely give that a chance, but movies is what we're here to talk about. And sometimes when I'm bored or I'm sitting here working at home and I like to put on something in the background to just like pass the time. And Netflix has this really awesome 90 minute option on their movies. And you can just scroll and each movie is around 90 minutes. Sometimes I fall a few minutes short. Sometimes I go a few minutes over, like this movie that I'm going to talk about, which is a 93 minutes. But I saw it poster on one that I was like, wow, that looks absolutely fun. And it turns out it was fun, but more importantly, it really tapped into something that I'm a big fan of, and that's movies like The Warriors and I can't even remember the name of the movie about Cherry 2000. That might have been the main name of the movie. I don't know. But there's a lot of really weird dystopian and then also gang themes in this movie. And the movie I'm talking about is 1984's Streets of Fire. Now, 1984, just so you know, was a pretty big year. It had Once Upon a Time in America. It had Gremlins. It had a whole slew of very entertaining movies. And then it had this movie, which was written and directed by, well, it was directed by Walter Hill, but co-written by Larry Gross and Walter Hill. And both are known for things like 48 Hours, the screenplays to The Alien and Aliens, and even Alien 3. Obviously, the one I mentioned before, The Warriors, this was those guys. And then things like Red Heat, which that's the Belushi, Arnold Schwarzenegger, awesome movie. awesome movie where Arnold is a Russian police officer has come to the United States to do some good. Be Arnolded up. But this one in particular, I'll go through the cast of characters and the stars before we get into the plot. And it's, I got to tell you, it's kind of a who's who. It's kind of a who's who and a who's that, I should say. To begin with, the main star of it, Tom Cody, is the character, but the name of the guy that plays it is Michael Parra, and I believe I'm pronouncing that right. His biggest claim to fame is that he was Eddie in two Cruising movies and also in The Philadelphia Experiment, which is a pretty, cult classic. I guess not the co-star, but definitely the focal point of the movie is the abduction of the main character, the lead singer of this pop band, this rock star, who's played by Diane Lane, who at the time was 18 years old, and this is well before she would ever be Martha Kent, among a million other roles. Then we also get a pre-Ghostbusters Rick Moranis, and it might not have been pre-Strange Brew. It might have gave him the cred to make a movie like Strange Brew. But it's certainly well before he shrunk any kids, busted any ghosts, or was KO'd outside that Manhattan hotel. He plays a character named Billy Fish, which is a great name, and the character is absolutely unlikable. After that is Amy Madigan, who's known for letting her husband plow corn into a baseball field, also Uncle Buck's girlfriend. Then we get into the heavy hitters, Willem Dafoe. Well before he terrorized Tobey Maguire in a green mask with pumpkin bombs, was a cross-dressing detective in Boondock Saints, mentored John Wick, or was most famously double-crossed by Tom Berenger when he was trying to fight the NVA in The Shit. Willem Dafoe is a character named Raven, who's a leader of a biker band, and he looks like a vampire through the whole thing, which makes me want a Willem Dafoe vampire movie, and we may have seen one, I don't know. But he has very few lines, and when he says them, they're chewy as all get out. It's the most overacted, weird. It's almost like it's an S&M gang leader, and you'll know if you watch the movie what I mean by that. After that, there's a police officer named Rick Rossovich. Well, the character or the actor that plays it. You guys know him as a shirtless volleyball player and co-pilot to the Iceman in Top Gun, and then you get Bill Paxton, Mr. Game Over Man himself, as a gapped tooth bartender. And what's more, his gapped tooth is clearly drawn in. Like it's penciled, like they've blacked out part of his tooth, and it doesn't look good on the screen. Other than that, there's Lee Ving, who's been in a bunch of movies. But the reason I highlight him, he's the number two man in this gang, this biker gang. But the reason I highlight him is because he will forever be known to me as Mr. Body from Clue, one of my favorite movies of all time. After that, we got a couple more, like Robert Townsend takes a turn as this other band that they kind of gets discovered through this. You guys may know him as Meteor Man, or you may not, because it was not really, really wildly seen. And then you have Elizabeth Daly, who probably is best known for stealing Smelly Cat and turning it into a jingle. And then Lane Thigpen, who was the busybody mother that tried to shut down Morgan Freeman in Stand By Me, and then also when he was the principal of school, and then also she was the one of my cult favorite movies. She was the DJ in The Warriors that was always relaying gang info out there. And then there was a bunch more, like I believe Ed Bagley Jr.'s in this movie. So What is this movie? A train wreck. That's what it is. It is a... Well, let's get into the reception of the movie. First off, Rotten Tomatoes gave it a 69%. Not a bad grade. 70% audience score. IMDb, 6.7 out of 10. And then you can... a big rabbit hole that I went down, which was fun. I looked up the Siskel and Ebert score of it, which was... You can go back and watch old episodes of Siskel and Ebert and really check out, like... And they have them, like, watermarked, so you can go right to the movie that you're interested in, which is very cool. So if you've got a real classic movie that you like that was made in the Siskel and Ebert era, it's really fun to check out and see what they said about it. And this one, Roger Ebert gave it one thumb up, and Gene Siskel gave it one thumb down. And Gene Siskel kind of cited what I feel about it, is this movie's caught being a bunch of different movies, and it really doesn't make sense. Now, it was a $14.5 million budget, and box office returns on it were $8.1 million, which we'll get into in a little bit. So not good. So the crowd did not like the movie. But what is the movie? Like I said earlier, it is a train wreck of a movie. That's putting it mildly, and in a good way. I mean, it starts off, and I'm not going to lie to you, Mr. Hummel would probably like some of the 80s style music in it. It's pretty good movie. In fact, a piece of trivia, and I'll get into more trivia here in a little bit. The movie was named after a song off of Bruce Springsteen's Darkness at the Edge of Town. In fact, they were supposed to use the song in the movie, and Bruce Springsteen gave them permission, but then he found out that they were going to give it to the lead character, Diane Lane, which also, spit of trivia, she doesn't do her own singing in it. So someone else was going to sing Bruce's song. When he found out about that, he retracted his permission. He said, because nobody sings the boss's music. Kind of a lot like a Prince stance, although Prince lightened up later in life. I don't know if Bruce has or not. He's still the boss, still a cool dude, and still certainly the target of worship by one Mr. Thomas Silver Badger Hummel. But anyway, so the movie's got a lot of good music in it. And there's even a song at the end of it that the final song that plays over the credits. When I was listening to it, and my wife walked through, and I said, "Hey, this sounds like a Meatloaf song." And lo and behold, another piece of trivia: a little bit later, or not much later after the movie was released, Meatloaf covered the song and released it himself, which made way more sense than the girl that sang, whoever the fake singer was for the movie, or whoever did the Milli Vanilli style singing of the movie that Diane Lane lip-synced to. But what the movie is so Diane Lane is the main character, or well, not the main character, but she's the focal point. She's the MacGuffin in the story. She is this small town, well, they say small town girl, but this is a city set in Chicago, although they don't call it the Chicago. They only go by the name of the boroughs, which aren't in Chicago. And like the Battery, I can't even remember where the good guys are, but it really is like a dystopian style future. But what's weird about it, it's got 50 style gang, biker gangs and like greaser gangs, but they're set in like old, like Studebakers, like 30s era Studebakers that they've converted into police cars and hot rods and things like that. And they never make a reference to the name of the city. They don't make a reference to the town. They just say another place, another time. I think that was one of the taglines in the movie, or maybe that's at the beginning. They do call it, as the credits open, they do call it a rock and roll, what do they call it? Let me see. It's a, I've got it right here. It is a, but you know what? I don't know that I have it. It's like a rock and roll. Oh, here it is. Yeah. Well, it's a rock and roll fantasy that they put. And they really wanted to lean into the rock and roll, but they don't really lean into the rock and roll, which is what's funny about it. It's there at the beginning, some at the end, and a little sprinkle of doo-wop right in the two-thirds of it. But so the singer, she's from this town, and she comes back to perform this concert, you know, back in her hometown. It's her return. And right as she's finishing up her set and does her bow, while slithering through the audience is Willem Dafoe and his group of ne'er-do-wells. He says, go, and they rush the stage, and he scoops her up and runs off the stage. And then his guys start wreaking havoc and whooping ass all over the place, from security to police to crowd-goers. Bill Paxton's there watching the show, and he even jumps up and gets beat up for his trouble, which is probably where he got the gap in his tooth, because it might have been a cracked tooth. So that's the whole premise of the movie. This woman's kidnapped. Somebody's got to save her. Of course, the police aren't doing very good at it. But who will do good at it is this diner owner, who happens to be friends with this girl, which is implied, sends a letter to her brother, Tom Cody, which is Michael Parra, and he says, I need your help. So he comes back in town to see his sister, And as he sits down at her diner, this group of, I want to say like 30s frat boys, because they're very much like the almost what was it like, not cheering squad, but like whatever it was called, the guys that would always carry the megaphones around in the 30s and football games. They're wearing like white khakis and red and white striped shirts, but their hair slicked back, look like very much a stereotypical 30s frat person. And they come in and give a little bit of trouble, and this whole scene is to set up two things. It's to give us a frame of reference for how badass Tom Cody is, because he single-handedly beats them all up and throws them through a window. And then the second thing is for him to get a car that he steals from them, because they leave their car behind after they run off instead of jumping in their car and driving off. But he beats their ass, takes their car. He goes, "Hey, look at my new ride." And she says, "Great, you can sell it and replace the windows you just broke." Ha ha, funny moment. But then they get in a car, and then he drives like a madman through town. Like, if you know Chicago, how the metro system rail works in Chicago, it's elevated. So he's weaving in and out of these support structures that elevate this thing, driving like, and then the cops, they turn on their lights and flash him. And there's a brief moment where you think, "Oh, it's silly. The cops aren't going to be able to catch him. And it's a stolen car. If they run the tags, it'll lead them back to the other gang instead." But no, he pulls over. This is where Slider comes into play. For those that don't know, Slider is Iceman's co-pilot, Rick Rossovich. He comes up and instantly, in a weird scene, and I'm not saying Slider or Rick was the greatest actor in Top Gun, but he is a master thespian of Shakespearean level compared to how bad he acts in this movie, which is a theme for most all the characters. He comes up to Tom Cody, and Tom Cody kind of is like, "Hey, why are you hassling me?" Well, he wasn't hassling you. You were driving like a fucking retard. Sorry. An idiot. Driving like a fucking moron in town. And he had to pull you over because you were being dangerous. Although there's one thing that should be noted. Very rarely, outside of the concert scenes or a bar scene that happens in a little bit, is there any other people in this town except when needed. They're almost like the ex machina of this city. They show up when needed, but you can't find them any other time. So they pull him over, and he's giving him a hard time, and then his boss, which I think is played by Stoney Jackson, this black police officer, comes up. He was riding along with him, and he goes, "Oh, Tom Cody. Okay." He goes, "You're back in town. Haven't seen you in forever." And he goes, "Hey, stop hassling me." And her sister's like, "Yeah, stop hassling him." Again, not hassling, doing their job. And he kind of lets him go. He goes, "Hey, I just don't want to see any trouble out of you." And he says, "Come on, let's leave this guy alone." They get back in the car, and Slider says, "What's that all about?" He goes, "Well, I busted that guy a few years back. Just another juvenile troublemaker. He had a gun in his car." That's all he says. And we don't know what happened. We don't know anything. That's all the world. But this terrible movie at world building. And I want you to keep track of how many times I say there's something bad about this movie, because they just don't do any great. They didn't do a great job of backstory. Maybe ambiguity and was kind of what they were going for, to be like this mysterious film. I don't know, but it doesn't accomplish what it needs to accomplish. Anyway, so his sister tells him all about, you know, the Diane Lane's character getting kidnapped, and that she goes, he's like, "Well, let me get this straight. My ex-girlfriend gets kidnapped, and you think I need to run back and be her savior? Okay, so now we have a connection." And she said, "Yeah," and she was living with this guy, Bobby Fish, who was her manager. And he said, "And boyfriend?" She goes, "I don't know. They just lived together." But we kind of get the impression they were kind of boyfriend. So he's like, "Well, let me get a meeting with this Bobby Fish. In the meantime, I'm going to go drink." So he goes to this bar, which is ran by Bill Paxton, who he says, "Man, what happened to you?" And Bill Paxton says, "Oh, I tried to stop the kidnapping and got my butt kicked." And he runs into this girl, McCoy, which is Amy Madigan. I think that was her name, right? Yeah, Amy Madigan, who fresh out of fighting the war. We don't know what war. We don't know why she just calls herself a soldier constantly. "But I'm good at working on cars and driving cars." Know what I mean? Which is funny, because in the entirety of the movie, she only drives a car twice, and at no time is it to run getaway. It's to be in a bus once, and in the very end of it. Doesn't make sense why they would throw that in there, other than change a tire on a bus. That might be the whole premise for giving her that. Again, very bad backstory in every part of this movie. So He becomes friends with her. She asks for another drink, and Bill Paxton proceeds to berate her for being a stupid woman and a dog face, and to which she responds by knocking Bill Paxton out, jumping across there, and grabbing a tequila for them both to drink, which just sets up their friendship immediately. So Tom Cody ends up meeting with Billy Fish, agreeing to go save her for $10,000. And, you know, which I guess is a lot of money then. I mean, certainly if you're a gypsy like Tom Cody seems to be, I'm guessing that's great money. And then he agrees to pay McCoy $1,000, or McCody, I think, or McCoy, that's it. McCoy $1,000 if she helps. And she's like, yeah, I got nothing better to do. I'm just a soldier looking for a battle. She doesn't really talk like that, but kind of, so it's fun. So they take Bobby Fish, because why wouldn't you take the stooge? And I guess I should say, too, reason Bobby Fish's character is so fucking unlikable is every line in this movie, he's insulting somebody. He insults McCoy for being a woman. You can't trust a woman to do the job and blah, 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 blah. And then if you want her, she's coming out of your pay because I ain't paying no more for some dame. And then he just insults Tom Cody constantly, left and right. It's bad writing, and delivered bad lines are delivered poorly, which you know, doesn't help. But anyway, they come up with this plan. They go raid this biker bar where they're keeping her captive. Probably the worst plan ever. And McCoy runs in, runs a stick up on the poker game that they're playing, in which the right hand man of Willem Dafoe's character Raven says, "You think you're going to get out of here without money?" And Willem Dafoe goes, she's not after the money. She's after something else. Which I want to talk real quick about Willem Dafoe's character Raven. First off, he's very astute. Perceptive. He's very perceptive. He knows that she's after the girl. But his whole reasoning, we find out, for kidnapping Diane Lane is because he wants to hook up with her. He even tells her, if you just give me a weekend, you'll find that I'm not a bad guy and you'll get home safely. So he kidnapped her, doesn't want money, just wants to get it on for a weekend, and then he will return her back. I'm not going to justify any of his actions, because it is kidnap and essentially forced sexual intimacy. But as far as nefarious plots of a bad guy go, kind of weak. Like, not very strong. Like, doesn't cut a finger off and send a message or anything like that. Of what you would the stakes aren't that high for what it is. But they're high enough, because, like I said, it is kidnapping and essentially rape. While McCoy, Amy Madigan's character, is holding up the game, Tom Cody climbs to the top of these pipes and starts shooting these bikers as they're driving by popping willies. Consistently driving. And after the first one drives by popping a willie, he shoots the tank and it blows up. He shoots two or three more that are continuing their trick festival and getting blown up. And then, like, you know, some just wreck and blow up, and everything blows up in this scene. I mean, there's fire everywhere. And when that happens, Tom Cody, you know, he created this diversion, and he sneaks in, and they bust in, and he grabs a knife, and he frees Diane Lane, and she's like, "What are you doing here?" And he's like, "I'm saving your life." And then they get out of there, and the part of their plan that's the most suspect is they tell Rick Moranis to come in exactly 15 minutes at the front door, and he's like, "You kidding me? They'll kill me. They'll recognize me. I'm from here. I used to book acts at this club," which I find hard to believe. He pulls up, everything goes well, and they run out. But right before they get in the car and run out, Willem Dafoe comes, best scene in the movie, creepily walking through the fire, and he looks at Tom Cody, goes, "I see you like to watch set the world on fire as much as I do." And Tom Cody goes, "Yeah, you don't pretend you and I are the same." And he goes, and then so Raven says, "Well, what's your name?" Dumbest move ever by hero. He goes, "Tom Cody." And he hops in the car and drives off. He goes, "I'll be seeing you soon, Tom Cody." But Tom Cody doesn't hear this. But Tom Cody's so smart, he knows that he's going to come for him. Which is okay, because we wouldn't have a fucking movie if he didn't. So anyway, at the end of all this, is they set up a scene. Well, first off, you got to know, Tom Cody is a hero. He ends up turning down the $9,000 and giving just the $1,000 to McCoy for helping him. And he was very... he was very dismissive of McCoy. He "I don't need you." But then he realized that, oh, she is cool. So he goes and collects the money to give her cut. And while trying to get away, the Diane Lane's mad at him for taking money to save her, but not so mad that she doesn't end up having sex with him anyway. And her boyfriend knows it, who's Rick Moranis, who's kind of a jerk anyway. So they're like, well, let's get out of here. And he's like, well, this ain't exactly over yet. And she's like, run away with me. And he's like, he fakes like he's going to do it, but he knows he's got to go back in town to eventually face Raven. And in order to do this, instead of just running or tricking her, he throws a right cross and knocks Diane Lane out. Very, you know, abusive. Just KOs her. And then goes, and because in the meantime, Raven goes to the Stoney Jackson and Slider, and he says, hey, I'm coming for Cody, but I just want you to know, I don't mean to tear everything down. It's just me and two of my guys, just to let you know that we're coming with we only want him, and we want to string him up and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So the cop tells Cody, hey, you got to get out of town, and if I see you or him, I'm going to arrest both of you. And so he's like, okay, whatever. So he doesn't listen. And obviously, so Willem Dafoe and his boys, they roll up. And they, the two guys roll up. And they're like, where's Cody? And he's like, he's not here. And then all the cops that we've never seen throughout this thing, like all these cops, we did see some other bad cops, not important. They pull their guns and like, yeah, well, you're not going to be doing anything bad today. And that's when Willem Dafoe's character Raven says, well, that's too bad, because I'd let Tom Cody know I've got guns too. And then like 200 bikers pull up with all these guns. And he's like, if you ever give me Tom Cody, or I'm going to tear the world apart. Which Tom Cody, stealing another car. Actually, by the time after they stole a bus, it's his third Grand Theft Auto in this, which the police seem to not mind. He pulls up and he walks up and he goes, Sheriff. And the sheriff goes, well, he's got his back against the wall now. Guess no other option. He goes, it's all right. I got this. He doesn't say that. I don't even know the dialogue in the movie. But he walks up and Willem Dafoe says, I brought a couple of things so we can settle this. And he's got two sledgehammers, possibly the worst weapons to have hand-to-hand combat with. You get one swing, and if you miss, you're wide open to get your ass kicked. But not these two. These two are fucking Jedis with these sledgehammers. It's like two lightsabers. They apparently have all the strength in the world. And they have this bit of an epic fight. Not a bad fight as far as sledgehammer fights go. Very reminiscent of Jason Momoa and Sylvester Stallone's axe fight in Bullet. Also, poorly devised fight. Just kind of silly. So they're having this fight. Tom Cody ends up getting the best of him. He has a chance of killing him. He throws his sledgehammer down. He's like, nah, not today. Not gonna fall to your level. Which enrages Willem Dafoe, and he gives him a Goldberg spear through like two or three bikes, and they flip and fall over everything. Like everything in their path, they fall over. And then they get up and have a hand-to-hand fight. And apparently, this should have been Willem Dafoe's option from the beginning, because he does much better in the hand-to-hand fight than he did in the sledgehammer fight. But lo and behold, Tom Cody saves the day. Beats him in a sledgehammer fight, or beats him with the fist fight and a sledgehammer fight. So it's Tom Cody 2, Willem Dafoe 0. And, you know, so then by this point, again, like I said, this ex machina of all the townspeople all are now outside in the street and pull guns. And so they now outnumber the bikers, and they're all pointing guns at the bikers. And the right hand man, Mr. Body from Clues, looks at Willem Dafoe passed out on the ground or knocked unconscious on the ground, and looks at the townspeople, and he looks at the other bikers, and he says, let's get out of here. And he scoops him up and they drive off. So good guys win, right? It's great. It's a good feel good story. The kind of the epilogue to it though is that, you know, Tom Cody and now Rick Moranis suddenly has a bit of a face turn and says, hey, I know you guys had a good thing going. I'm not going to stand in the way of you and Diane Lane. And Tom Cody says, hey man, I ain't about that life. I'm not some dude that can run around carrying some girl's guitar. So you don't got to worry about me. And he goes up to Diane Lane in the best Casablanca style ripoff and gives him he doesn't exactly word for word say it, but essentially said, here's looking at you, kid. And he walks off and he gets outside and McCoy's outside and she's got this car. She's got the car that Tom Cody stole, the red Studebaker with the chop top. She goes, hey, like my new ride? He goes, yeah, need a co-pilot? And she says, get in. Where are we going? Who knows? We're going wherever the road takes us. Essentially, that's what they say. Then they drive off, and that's when Diane Lane, and the band the doo-wop band they discovered midway through opens up for Diane Lane's character, and they have a second concert, or they finish their original concert that they weren't able to because of the kidnapping, and they play the song that was a pretty cool, ends up being Meatloaf song. That's the whole movie. I know I've been ripping on the movie for a while, and I want you to count how many times I said there was something stupid and shitty, but I give this movie a 4 out of 5, probably a 3.75, 4 out of 5. I loved it. I loved all 93 minutes of it. It's the kind of, it's like Solar Babies for me. If you've never seen Solar Babies, it's the dumbest movie, and maybe I'll do a review on that one. It's essentially, it was at the peak popularity of rollerblades, and the whole point of the movie is these rollerblading kids have to escape this far post-apocalyptic future, but there's enough pavement around the world that they rollerblade everywhere. It's more complicated than that. Still pretty simple in the plot. We'll have to get into it, but my point is that's a really bad movie that I enjoy. This is a really bad movie, and I enjoyed it. So you got to take in consideration when I do these one man's bad movie review, and I don't even know if this was a bad movie review or a review of a bad movie. You can be the judge of that, but these scores, you're going to have to take them with a grain of salt, because I enjoy a shitty movie from time to time. Just know that going into it. The problem it had, it's not quite campy enough to be a classic, but it's still fun and silly mid-80s, like with the romp through fake greasers and a weird world and biker gangs and just not enough world building to really... I'm going to dial it back. It's a 3.5. How about that? It's a 3.5. If it would have did better in its world building and its backstory, it would have been a 4. You know, to give a comparison, I'll never review this movie because I don't consider this quirky or campy. Well, it is a little campy, but Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai. That's a 5. That is a movie that gives you all the world building, all the backstory on your characters that you need, and then some. And then it delivers on great performances from guys like John Lithgow and Peter Weller. Ellen Barkin. At the height of her hotness. Great movie. This, not there, still enjoyable. So I'd give it a chance, or give it a shout. A little bit of trivia about it, though, that I thought I liked. It was supposed to be a trilogy starring Michael Parra. It was supposed to be the career-making role of Michael Parra. The poor box office returns canceled those plans, in spite of some pretty okay, above-average reviews. Michael Parra also, by the way, had a major problems with a lot of people in this movie, like from the production to the cast. In fact, in one person in particular he hated was Rick Moranis. Apparently, whatever Rick Moranis was doing on screen, he took that persona off screen, and it just rubbed a lot of people, but mainly Michael Parra, the wrong way. Michael Parra so much so that he went and bitched, but the producer of this movie was Joe Silver, who was Rick Moranis's one of his best buds at the time. And just so you know, those two would go on the lake, make a cajillion dollars shrinking kids and other things with Disney. So Michael Parra just lost that out. And it was probably a smart move on Joe Silver's part to keep that relationship going, because everything worked out for them. There was the bar scene. There was this dancer, and it was the only time we saw boobs in the movie. She, for a brief moment, pulls her shirt up while dancing, sexy dancing, and you see her nippler area. Her name was Maureen Jahan. I don't know. Jahan. She was the stunt double for Jennifer Beals in Flashdance. That Jennifer Beals. I told you about the film's title, but one of the other things about this, what was funny is because there was a lot of people in the film that were 18 and around the age of 18, like the lead, well, not the lead, but one of the actresses in Diane Lane, they used, of the $14.5 million budget, they used $1.2 million to build a giant tent that would allow them to cover sets during filming, because child labor laws would not let them film at night too long with the actors and actresses that were young. So they wanted it to look like nighttime all the time in the movie, so they had to build this big tent so they could shoot in the day. Poor planning on their part. But it accomplished what it was going. I only say poor planning in retrospect because it didn't make any money, but I guess it was a work through to execute getting around child labor laws. And then the final thing I'll say about it, and I guess the lasting legacy for this movie, if there's anything to be taken about it, or if it has a lasting legacy, would be it was the chief inspiration, apparently, according to Wikipedia and the interwebs, for both the video games Final Fight and Streets of Rage. If you guys don't know, both of those games were on Super Nintendo and Sega, but both of those games really were awesome at the arcade, especially Final Fight. Final Fight was one of the best arcade games, so check those out. If you've never played those games, at least watch them, the gameplay on them. Those were well ahead of their time in terms of side scroller. They weren't really side scrollers, I guess. I don't know what it was called. It's not a side scroller, but it was definitely platform style, but you could only go linear. It was very linear in storytelling, but you could use, it was one of the first games in both games, but especially Final Fight, where you could, you know, throw people into parts of the scenery around you and break it and do cool shit. Final Fight was an awesome game. So there you go. That is my one man's bad movie review, or one man's review of a bad movie. Take it either way you take it. I really enjoyed it, and I'm going to do more of these. Hopefully not too many more of them, like I said, because we don't want a lot of solo episodes, because frankly, I don't think people like them as much. No one's ever told me, and the numbers still seem good, but I'm always appreciative, even if you guys don't listen, if you download. But if you are listening and you get to this point, we appreciate you even more. I guess that's all I got. That, you know, my, we're going to go back for my final verdict for this movie, Streets of Rage, 1984, magnus opus of Larry Gross and Walter Hill and Michael Parra's, his ultimate achievement in cinematic history, 3.5 out of 5, because it just needs a little bit more. But for 93 minutes, it's a pretty fun movie to put in the background and hear some good music every once in a while, which was kind of a shocker. I don't think I have anything else. All I've got to tell you is that we'll be back to normal next week, and the week after that will be even more normal, and the week after that might be a regular episode. I don't know. We'll see what happens. What will happen is no one will say bye, but I am going to play the music.